Welcome to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and our guest today on Writer's Voices is joining us from halfway around the world, Daphne Suman. She was born in Istanbul and grew up on Prinkipo Island. She studied sociology at the Bosphorus University and later continued her studies in Oregon in the U.S. The Silence of Scheherazade was first published in Turkey and Greece in 2015, and this is her English language debut. So it is this year came out in English. And I believe Daphne is joining us from Athens. Is that correct, Daphne?
That's correct. Hello, everyone. It's so nice to be here with you all.
Well, welcome. So you're quite a well-traveled author. If you born in Istanbul, grew up on an island, now you're in Athens, you've studied in Oregon. Any place else that we missed in that?
Yeah, I actually traveled. So when I finished university and then I did my graduate studies and then I started traveling east as opposed to west. And usually, you know, if you're from Istanbul, your first destination is Europe, Western Europe, and then from there, United States, Canada. And that's how you travel. But I picked the other way around. And so I went to East and I went to Thailand. I went to Laos, India, and I lived in those countries for a few years. And then from there, I came to the United States and I lived in Portland for 10 years. And then after that, I completed my round and landed in somewhere very close to Istanbul in Athens.
So Greece and Turkey have a very complicated history, don't they?
Yes, they do. And not only history, they have a complicated present time too.
Yes. I spent a couple of weeks on Lesbos a couple of years ago. And of course, from my hotel, I could see Turkey. And actually, I did go over one day, took the ferry across. But this, and as I'm sure you're well aware, Lesbos is where a lot of refugees are coming by boat from Turkey. Is that still happening?
As far as I know, not as aggressively as it was happening before COVID. With the COVID, there's been some slowing down of the refugees. There's more controls, there's more checkpoints. I think so. They slowed it down, but definitely it's still going on. Not to the extreme levels that it was 2 years ago, but there's still influx of refugees, both entering Turkey from the Syrian border, right, and then the ones who are wealthy enough to afford the passage to Europe are still traveling, are still passing from Turkey, western border of Turkey into Greece, and then hopefully they're hoping to go further into the Western Europe from here, from Greece.
And it was tragic what was happening there. The camps were so overcrowded. Of course, people were dying in the ocean getting there.
Yeah.
And then there was a fire in one of the camps, I think, after COVID hit. And my heart really bleeds for that island that tried to welcome people but was completely overrun.
And it's like, it's true for the entire Greece as a country. It's not prepared to the influx of this many people with its economy, with its resources, with its land. But you can also say the same thing for Turkey, which has at least 20 times more refugees being hosted in Turkey right now. Again, the system is not there. It's not ready to, I mean, nowhere in the world is ready to get an entire country's population fleeing into their land.
No.
So it's a global tragedy on every level.
It is. And it's easy for those of us thousands of miles away to like say, well, it's not our problem, but it is really. It should be.
It's a humanity's problem. Like it's the human race altogether, because today, it's Syria. It's the people of Syria who are fleeing from their countries. Who knows who is going to be next?
Yeah.
So it's, you know, it's nothing to do with the land or geography. It's a human crisis in general, where we are as a humanity right now, in any time, and this, my book, The Silence of Shehrazad, is a little bit about that. Like,
yes,
anything can happen anytime. And then one day you're having your fish and French fries and looking at the refugees and thinking, oh, how poor guys, what are they going to do? And then next day it's you who is in the boat and trying to find a safe country that is ready to host you if you're lucky.
And that, you're right, that is part of what The Silence of Shehrazad is about.
Yes.
So
yes.
Give us a little bit of background of where it's set. And
okay.
Yeah.
Well, before I do that, that's why I actually dedicated the book to those who have been exiled from their homeland. And I was thinking about the people who are fleeing from Syria when I was writing that. And many of the discourses that we use in Greece and in Turkey about people who are running away from war existed at the early 20th century, at the beginning of the 20th century, again, which is a very similar times to what we are going through right now. Again, a lot of wars, a lot of refugee crisis, a lot of moving around, and a lot of viruses, like epidemics, pandemics going on early 20th century. Anyway, so my book is taking place early 20th century in the Ottoman Empire. Ottoman Empire is about to dissolve, about to disappear from the face of the history. It's the end of the First World War, which is 1914 to 1918. And as the Ottoman Empire is disappearing, is dissolving, the greater forces, the greater countries, meaning England, France, a little bit United States, Italy, are trying to distribute the land, who is going to get what, and what's really happening to the lives of people who are living on that land. This is basically the story. The Silence of Shehrazad is the unspoken history of what really happened back then. Mm-hmm. Unspoken in a way, unspoken in Turkey, because this is where I'm from and this is where I learned the official history. So one of my tasks in this story is to reverse the official history and take a look what really happened to human beings when Ottoman Empire was turning into what we know as the modern Turkish Republic today.
Now, it's set in the city of Smyrna. Am I saying that correctly?
Yes, yes. It's set in the city of Smyrna, and Smyrna is an important harbor town of Ottoman Empire. So everybody knows about Istanbul. Istanbul was capital and it was rich and it was more famous. But Smyrna back then was as famous as Istanbul too. It was a very rich harbor town which had five different languages were spoken in Smyrna, they used to say, and there are at least five different religious groups lived side by side in Smyrna. So it was, compared to Istanbul, it was a more cosmopolitan city, richer because it had all the ship-making companies were established there, and a lot of Europeans lived in, Western Europeans, French, Levantines, we call them Levantines, the Europeans who lived in the Mediterranean area. Mediterranean area is called the Levantines. So Smyrna had a lot of rich Levantine families dealing with shipmaking and travel agencies and building roads, building railroads. So lots of figs, lots of grapes, lots of export, a very rich town. And because they were rich, maybe quite a happy place to be and very beautiful. So when I wanted to find a place that whose destruction will make us the saddest, I can't think of a better place than Smyrna, because A, it was very beautiful. Like they said, it was like a well-knitted shawl, something like that. Everything was made with care and beauty. The second thing is destruction is through a fire. So it's one of the aggressive, most aggressive destructions of a harbor town is by burning it. So I wanted to pick this place. I wanted to tell its story, but also I wanted to tell another story, which is like how beauty or our regular, our usual lives could be destroyed in a matter of a day. And I think this was the best metaphor, Smyrna in Ottoman Empire, and its very, very sad, very tragic end was the best metaphor to bring my project into life.
So how long did you work on this novel?
I think overall, well, I wrote it quite fast. It was as if a force was pushing me into it. I was in Portland, Oregon. I was doing all my research actually in the libraries of Oregon, and they were very, very good. They brought every book I needed. So I was writing and doing research and writing and doing research. In 1 year, I completed it.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And it was longer than what you have. Like now it's a 500-page book. It was much longer when I finished it. So I needed to, I worked with my editor and we made it shorter because like I wanted to give every little detail. I wanted to construct that world and I wanted to put every little detail of that world. And then my editor said, you know, maybe you don't need this much detail. We got the picture.
Well, and it can take longer to write in fewer words. Sometimes, because you have to
definitely
choose the best
like
words.
Now I'm trying to write short stories. It's so hard. It takes 1 year again to complete a tiny short story book I have completed, and it was just published in Turkey. It took me another year to complete that, and this 500-page book same. Wow. But this was one of the luckiest times of my life. I was fully focused on writing the book. I didn't have anything else to do. I didn't have to do anything else. So 1 full year in Portland, I worked on the book, and that was such a blessing. I wasn't aware of it later. You know, I had to do much more things, but fully focused 1 year, let's say.
You're listening to Writer's Voices, and our guest today is Daphne Suman, and we are talking about The Silence of Scheherazade. Now, before we get a little further, any further in, Scheherazade also has, she's the character in the book, but isn't there a historical context to that?
Too? Yes. There is a historical context, there's a literature context. So Scheherazade is the narrator of 1001 stories, or as known as the Arabian Nights. So these are like fairy tales. Maybe some of our listeners know about it. These are fairy tales of the Middle East. So we, the children of the Middle East, in Turkey, we grew up listening to reading and listening from our parents, from our grandparents, the stories in the 1001 Nights. And Scheherazade is the narrator of those stories. So what she does is that there's a very cruel emperor, and he wants to kill young women after getting married to them. The next morning, like, he goes to bed with them, and then the next morning he kills them. So Scheherazade is the only exception. She manages to stay alive by telling stories. Mm-hmm. So she says, okay, you can kill me, but let me tell you a story before you kill me. So she tells it's such a beautiful story that the emperor needs to hear the rest of the story. So he allows her to stay alive, let's say, one more day and one more day. And that goes on for 1001 days. And Scheherazade keeps telling the stories. So in a way, and then Scheherazade is also a name that you can actually name. It's a little old fashioned, but you can name your child, your girl child, Scheherazade. So when I was looking for a name for my character, I picked Scheherazade. I'm not quite sure. I wasn't really thinking very abstract stuff. I just liked the name Scheherazade. But later I thought, and I picked a Scheherazade who is not talking, like who chooses to stay silent. Everybody thinks she's mute. Everybody thinks like she lost the ability to speak. That's not true. She actually chooses not to speak for the reasons our readers will find out as they turn the pages. But the silence of Scheherazade in the traditional context, in the context of 1001 Nights, is her death. If a Shehrazad becomes silent, that means the very cruel, the very mean emperor will kill her. So I wanted to play with the words here. What does it mean, a silent Shehrazad? What is, like, somebody who's supposed to tell stories, if she's quiet, what happens to us?
So when you were writing this, and you said you were living in Oregon at the time,
yes,
had you spent much time in Smyrna where you could recall the details of being there?
That's the funny thing. When I started writing the book, I have never been to Smyrna. That's the beauty of writing. Smyrna today is known as Izmir. The Turkish word for Smyrna is Izmir. It's the third biggest city of Turkey. There's Istanbul, Ankara, and there comes Izmir. But I have been to Izmir back. Now I've been to Izmir many times. Back then, no, I've been there only once or twice, didn't know the city at all. And I started writing it thinking that I'm crazy. Probably I'm going to stop writing this because, like, and I studied Smyrna from the maps, from the old maps, from the insurance maps of the early 20th century. So every inch of it I learned from the maps, every corner, every street, every hill, every little square I learned from the maps. And then I think at the end of that 1 year, I said, okay, now I'm going to Izmir and just to do a little bit more research. So at the end of summer in September, I went there and it was a completely different place. I was lost. I was asking, like, do you know where is this Aydın train station? And everybody was looking at me like a blank. There is no such place because it was like 100 years ago. The name of the station changed to Alsancak train station. And so an old guy laughed at me. You are the only one who is calling it still. So things change. But, you know, I found my way and I realized the city is much bigger than I thought. So I had to change some of the things in the book, like the distances. It took 10 minutes for us to walk there. I realized, no, it takes 1 hour to walk from one place to the other. So my trip to Izmir was helpful in terms of understanding the geography of the city, which you cannot understand from a two-dimensional map. But the rest of the things, surprisingly, I figured it out by... reading books and looking at maps.
Now, was this your first novel that you wrote?
No, this is my second novel. My first novel was actually a fiction version of my graduate thesis.
Okay, which was about what?
Which was about actually women in Turkey who chooses to cover themselves in an Islamic way. Not that they have to, not that they're forced, but the ones who actually wants to go and become more traditional and cover their heads. That was the main, that was my topic of dissertation thesis. And then I made, I wrote a book about a very secular, very modern family's daughter wants to become religious and chooses a Muslim boyfriend and then goes and covers herself and what kind of a conflict it creates in the family, in her own individual self and things like that. That wasn't translated to English yet. And I want it to be translated, so I'm working on it because I'm writing the second part of this book after 10 years. Now I'm working on the second part.
Of that first book?
Of that first book, yes.
And what's the second part? It just takes her further into her life? Or?
No, it's not the second part, really. She's one of the main characters of another character's life.
Okay.
Yeah. The second one, the one I'm working on right now is all about Istanbul. And just like the way we have the destruction of Smyrna in the Silence of Shehrazad, the book I'm currently working on is talking about the destruction of Istanbul, not through aggressive fire, but through like all the five-star hotels being built and skyscrapers being built everywhere, shopping malls being built. So that kind of a destruction of Istanbul, the old historical town disappearing in the hands of the global capitalism.
So you write in Turkish?
I write in Turkish. I have an amazing translator. She's an school teacher, English teacher, an American woman who lives in Turkey, who have lived in Turkey for, I don't know, 50 years, for the last 50 years, I think. So speaks excellent Turkish, has an excellent taste of literature. So she's Betsy Göksel, her name, and she's my translator.
How did you find her?
I was looking for a translator and I asked friends and they said, you know, there's this school teacher from 1960s and still living in a small island in the north of Turkey. You may want to contact her. Maybe she wants to do that. So I said, okay, because translation is very, very expensive. So I said, okay, I'll ask her. And I contacted her and she said, well, I am a translator, but I haven't done translations for some time. Let me try, and if you like it, we continue. So I sent her a sample, and she sent me back a sample, and it was amazing. And I said, let's do this. Then it turned out to be one of the best decisions I have made.
Now, Daphne, your spoken English is flawless, as far as I can tell. Could you write, or have you ever thought of writing in English?
No, I can't. I tried. I mean, I tried. It's so hard to write in English. I can actually. I wrote my thesis. My master's thesis was in English. So I can write academic stuff. I can write easily nonfiction, but when it comes to literature, somehow I need to go to my mother tongue. It's something in your mind that your very innermost core, your heart, that language is what you learned the first from your mother, I think. So because I learned Turkish and I learned Turkish from my mother, let's say, and I learned English much later at school, when I start writing something, it always comes to me in Turkish.
Mm-hmm. And once you've written it, I mean, could you translate your own work?
That's also very, very difficult. I tried, believe me, like in the second sentence, I was like, no way. I don't know how to give this, because language is a very funny thing. It's not just you don't translate word by word. You're translating an energy of a sentence. And that energy of the sentence, you need a certain grammatical structure to give the energy. And the moment I start translating something, I realize that I don't know the grammatical structure to give that energy to the reader. The time, the possibilities, a lot of things are hidden in the grammar that we don't notice when we speak the language as a native speaker. And when you start thinking about it, shall I say would, shall I say should, shall I say have, and all those things make it give a different, not necessarily a different meaning, but a different taste to the to your sentence. And I can't pick that which one to choose. I can't decide.
I can definitely understand that. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I think you're right. I don't think authors really hardly ever translate their own work.
I have a friend, actually. She says she translates every book she writes, not for professional reasons, but she says, I understand my stories much better. I understand where my book is, like, where there's a problem in my plot line. I understand much better when I translate. And I think, you know, I'm amazed that she's doing that. Like I said, I couldn't even go further the third sentence.
Well, how involved were you with your translator?
I was very much involved. Yeah.
Yeah.
Every chapter. we worked together, and in that way, she also, she was an excellent translator in that way, because after every chapter, she sent it to me, and I read it, and I added things, I changed things, and let's call this that way, and let's call this this way. And then she was, Betsy was able to follow up everything I suggested in the next chapter. So I never repeated one feedback again, because it was there. Mm-hmm. So chapter by chapter, actually, we went together. And let me tell you this also, Monica. The book is written in an old Turkish, because it's older people speaking, and it's an old time. So it's an extra challenge for the translator to understand what these – it's not a modern Turkish. I literally opened dictionaries and looked for older words to say things. So whenever she didn't know what it means, some older words, I was there to help. And mm-hmm. then there is some everyday slang that, again, needed my help in translation. But overall, most things were already coming ready to my hand, and I was just putting a little bit of feedback here and there.
Well, Daphne, would you read a little bit from The Silence of Scheherazade?
Why not?
Why
I
not?
Would love to read. Okay. I would love to read. Let me see. All right. So I'm going to read a chapter, the final chapter of the part one. So the book is made out of five parts with many chapters in each part. And this one is the end of the finale of the first part. And it's called Gypsy Yasemin's Web of Secrets. And from then on, my dears, every afternoon in that house with a garden at the end of Vasili Street, those two, you know who, would, beneath a blanket of smoke from the hashish in the water pipe, what acrobatics, what tricks, don't ask me about the rest. By the time I heard this story, neither Edith nor Avinash nor Vasili Street, where the house in which they met and made love every afternoon was located, remained. But Gypsy Yasemin still walked the streets, going door to door, enthralling women with her tales of the rich Europeans. Much time had passed since they'd found me, just before dawn, in the garden of the house on Bülbül Street, unconscious. Maybe 1 year, maybe two, I don't know. Time had lost its significance. I didn't venture out into the streets of my ruined city. But in spite of all the suffering I had endured, in spite of my losses, I was young. And with the fierce strength of the young, I kept going. Under a new name, from within the warm embrace of the Turkish family who had taken me in, with no questions asked, I adjusted to my new life. I had become silent Scheherazade, with no past, no people, no speech. The power of speech, which I lost on the morning they found me, had still not returned. It was never going to return. In a way, this was a good thing, because people who spoke my language were being hounded out of the villages in which they had lived for 1,000 years and sent to a faraway shore. I didn't want to ever be separated from cinnamon-scented Sümbül, who had restored me to life, or from other things in that house. Gypsy Yasemin would lay out the items she had unpacked from her bundle on the large decorative wrought iron table left over from the time of the Europeans. As soon as she began telling this love story of Edith and Avinash from 20 years back, all women would gather in the kitchen to listen to her, their mouth hanging open. Sümbül, her widowed sister-in-law, Makbule Hanım, Neni Dilber from Ethiopia, and myself, Elias Scheherazade. The kitchen smelled of bergamot and onions, which Gülfidan, a refugee from Lesbos, was forever slicing. Nanny Dilber, black-skinned and quite as massive as Gypsy Yasemin herself, would pack wood into the huge oven, another relic from the Europeans, and fry red mullet in olive oil. I would prepare a salad with mustard greens and endives that I had gathered from the garden, as well as poppies and hackberries Yasemin had brought down from the mountains. We all had moved to the house known as the mansion with the tower, which was bigger. It had been given to Sümbül's husband, Colonel Hilmi Rahmi, as a reward for his success during the war. Only Hilmi Rahmi's father, the grumpy Mustafa Efendi, remained in the old house on Bülbül Street at the top of the Muslim neighborhood. Our boy Avinash had not much experience with women before, but he was a good student. In Edith's arms, he quickly became an expert. How do I know this? Let's just say I heard it from the cats on Vasili Street, okay? Next to me, Sümbül, still sane at that point, leaned her elbows on the table, settled her blonde head and plump cheeks between her palms like a child, and listened to the story she had already heard countless times from the bundle peddler. Her green eyes grew wide, and she even set down her peacock feather fan, laying it on top of earthenware wheat jar. She was intrigued by the adventures of the Europeans. They had given Smyrna its color, its sounds, its distinctive flavor, until they were lost to the city in that one night. She latched onto Yasemin's tales of the old days as if clutching a life belt. The contents of the gypsy's bundle lay on the table. Lengths of linen, silk, lace. It was said that the gypsy went into chalets and villas and mansions of Burnabat, Buja, and Paradiso that had been abandoned by the Greeks and Armenians fleeing for their lives, and took dresses, jewelry, hats, whatever. It was true that on occasion a very fashionable linen dress would emerge from her bag, its armpits bearing the scent of distant places, its collar, lace, and underskirt of the highest quality, obviously cut by expert scissors. A place has ears. Then those two, Avinash and Edith, slid beneath the mosquito netting of an afternoon. The house servants weren't sleeping. Were they? When I read their fortunes from the coffee grounds later, they couldn't stop talking. Speaking of fortunes, fill up a coffee cup and let me read the fortune of this silent Shehrazad. Why is she so sad? What caused her to be tongue-tied? Let us find a cure for her troubles.
Thank you. And that's Daphne Suman reading from The Silence of Shehrazad. Could you give us just sort of an overview of the historical events that are going on during the scope of this book?
Of course. The book begins in 1905, which is before the First World War, and the Ottoman Empire is still intact. And Smyrna is a rich town, harbor town, and Europeans, Greeks, Armenians, Jewish communities, and Turkish people live together, and they are relatively rich compared to the other parts of the empire. And when the First World War ends, the Smyrna is given to the Greeks, because the whole Ottoman soil, the Ottoman geography, was distributed between the powers who won the First World War, and Greece is one of the countries won the First World War. So Brits got one part, French got another part, Italians another part, and Smyrna is given to Greeks. That created a lot of unrest in the Turkish populations of the land, and they started their national independence war as a reaction to Smyrna's being given to Greeks. So that started in Ankara, in the center of the country, by Mustafa Kemal, who is the founder of Turkish Republic. And at the same time, Smyrna has been ruled for 3 years by Greek administration. And what happened to the people of Smyrna, the Greeks, the Armenians, the Turks, the Jewish, and the French, they become slowly enemies of one another. So there is more and more polarization was taking place. And the Turkish independence, Turkish resistance, let's say, Turkish national resistance that was gathered in Ankara, and it slowly grew stronger and stronger, and they started coming west to, in a way, quote-unquote, clean the whole land from the foreign powers. And the final place, so they had agreements with the British, they had agreements with the French, they had agreements with the Italians, and slowly, slowly they moved out of what is Turkey. The last place remained was Greek administered Smyrna. And when Turkish army arrived there, it was a big defeat of the Greek or Greek army, and they fled. The Turkish army had a very obvious and huge victory, and they got the control of Smyrna, but at the same time they have massacred a lot of Christian populations of Smyrna. Some of them tried to flee, some of them were killed, some of them were sent to Greece, but it was a very sad, and the city was burned in the middle of that.
Was so that intentional? Did they intentionally set fire to
the
city?
Well, it is still a contradictory theme. Like, nobody knows. There was the fire started in the Armenian neighborhood. Armenians formed a very strong resistance against the Turkish army entering Smyrna. They were hoping that Europeans will help the Christian populations of Smyrna, the Armenians and Greeks. They were expecting help from French and British ships that were out of the Smyrnian harbor, and they received no help. So some say Armenians started the fire, and there was a very strong wind that night. It went all the way and burnt the whole city. Some eyewitnesses say that, no, it was actually Turkish soldiers putting fire in the Greek and Armenian neighborhoods. Some narrative says that it was Greeks, the Greek army, who is running away. They set fire to Smyrna before they left. It's actually unknown. But like, what's unknown is who started the fire. What is known is it was started by some groups, let's say.
Yeah.
But I don't want to go into discussion of this thing in my book. It's a very let's say very fiery discussion even to this day, who started the Smyrna fire. It really doesn't matter. What matters is that the entire city was burned, beauty was burned, like wealth was burned, and it was one of the greatest creations of human race, and it's burned to ashes.
Wow.
And this is a loss for all of us. And I think I just wanted to talk about this loss in this book, because even though we have a lot of Turkish characters, and we have like people who are fighting in Atatürk's Mustafa Kemal's army, and they are actually in the forces that are entering Smyrna at the end of the book, Hilmi Rahmi is one of them, one of the main characters. It's also his loss, and he feels the burning of Smyrna as a pit in his stomach. He's losing his city. It's becoming ashes because of this this unending conflict and negotiations of greater powers over smaller lands.
So the book continues past the point of the fire?
Yes. The Shehrazad is our narrator, the silent Shehrazad, and she's telling the story from today. Not from today, not from 2015, 2005 she's telling the story. By that time, she is 100 years old. That's one of my favorite themes, 100-year-old narrators. I love them. So she's a 100-year-old narrator. She is still alive and writing from a tower this story. And so it does end at the night of the fire in a way, but then there are chapters like the one I read, it's after Smyrna is burned. So there are a few chapters we have a glimpse of the life of Shehrazad after the great fire, after she becomes Shehrazad because she's somebody else. And throughout the book, the readers, one of the sweet jobs of the reader is to find out which one of these characters is Shehrazad, because there are we have three women and one of them is our Shehrazad. It's obvious because she says, actually, my mother, this and that, you know. So the reader's job is to find out which one, and most people, they find out at the, you know, by the time they're at the middle of the book, they're like, oh. And some readers were like, at the very end, they realize, no, how I never realized that. It's like, that's why I like reading books at least twice or three times sometimes. And I hope my readers, I know it's a long book, but I, you know, I read Anna Karenina maybe five times in my life, and I can read another five times. It really doesn't matter how many books we read in one life. It does matter how many times we read a book that we really liked.
I love that.
Yeah. So I hope my readers, once they finish and once they understand who is Shehrazad and what happened, what was this whole confusion at the beginning, I hope they go back knowing the plot now, knowing who is who, knowing what causes what, they can read again from the beginning and they will find, they will enjoy it as much as I enjoy writing it. The first time you read it, usually you're like, what's happening? Who is this? Where are we? What country is this? The second time is like, you're home. You're home and bring your meal.
That's a very, that's an excellent suggestion. Yeah. So Armenian, where is Armenia and why were there so many Armenians in Smyrna?
Well, Armenia, Armenia is a country that is founded at the end of the First World War. There was no Republic of Armenia up to that point, as far as I know. I might be making a mistake, but I think that's the case. So Armenians, the home of Armenians, it's today's Turkey. It's, we call it Anatolia or Asia Minor, you can call it. So that's the original home of the Armenians. And even today, we have some Armenians living in Turkey, although they went through huge massacres and most of them, a lot of them died. Some of them managed to escape, and we have a huge Armenian diaspora living outside of Turkey. And some still, some, of course, ended up in the Republic of Armenia. But back then, in the Ottoman times, Armenians lived in their home, which is Asia Minor, which is Anatolia, which is Turkey's geography today. So that's why Smyrna, being one of the cities of Ottoman Empire, had its own Armenian population, just like Istanbul had its own Armenian population, and the rest of Turkey back then, the rest of Ottoman Empire has its own Armenian populations. And so it was a normal thing for Ottoman Empire to have Greeks, Armenians, Western Europeans, Muslim Turks living all together in their cities. That was the demographics of Ottoman Empire. It wasn't only Muslim Turks. It was an empire. So it had like the Serbs and Greeks and Armenians all together living under their own religious heads. There weren't any states, but there were religious groups. Mm. So it was like United States, but only united religions together, ruled by one federal state, which was the Sultan in Istanbul.
Okay.
But
okay.
Every group was independent in their own, in their system of like how you manage your community was decided by the religious leaders of that community, who were responsible for taxes and stuff to the center, to Istanbul center.
Now, many of us had never, I don't think, had learned about the tragedy of Smyrna and the Armenians until we read a novel some years ago called Middlesex, and I understand that this novel also influenced you.
Yes, Middlesex is the father of Scheherazade, let's say. So actually, that's when I opened my eyes to the we call it the catastrophe of Smyrna, this burning of Smyrna, disappearing of Smyrna. I opened my eyes for the first time when I read Middlesex. Of course, like when you are from the country that lost the city of Smyrna, you don't learn much about what really happened. You have the official version of your country's history makers. And Middlesex was the first time I realized civilians, women, children, older people, the residents, the citizens of Smyrna were killed in the fire of Smyrna. And the moment I read Middlesex, and of course there was a very violent scenes of how Turkish soldiers went into the, or maybe Turkish gangs, not necessarily, it's not very clear. It could be gangs, it could be soldiers, how they went into the Armenian neighborhood the moment they enter Smyrna, and they massacred the Armenians people in the neighborhood. And that's also something I learned from Middlesex. And then I actually did research, and yes, that happened. And all those things I learned, when you're living in Turkey, you don't know about these things. So when I learned it, I felt like, okay, this is going to haunt me if I don't write about this. And that's why
so
I call
was
Middlesex
that
the father.
And Middlesex, of course, is by Geoffrey Eugenides.
Yes,
it was published in how long ago? It's quite a while, 20
years
ago,
2000
maybe?
Or 2001.
Yeah,
let me see. I have it here. Yeah,
2000 and the paperback came out in 2002, so it was probably published before then. And was it controversial then for you? You know, when you published this book in Turkey, what kind of response did you get? Was it controversial? Were there people who did not want this story brought to light?
Very few. Surprisingly, very few reacted. 95% of the people was very thankful. And because it's not an anti-Turkey book, it's the story of what really happened. It's the story of suffering of human beings, and it's the story of loss. And I think I was able to tap into the loss, and that's why people found something that they are feeling inside. The loss is in the inside of the hearts of the people. So when they actually read what happened, they said, okay, now that makes sense. Now that makes sense why I feel so sad when I go to Smyrna. Now that makes sense why I feel so sad when I go to Greece and meet with the Greek people. So it's surprisingly in Turkey, I got very good positive feedback. Like people, the readers, of course, you know, the literature reader is someone who is already open-minded, somebody who is already willing to exercise their mind, to make their minds more flexible. And in Turkey, we have a, thanks to the current conditions of Turkey, we have a large group of people who are ready to criticize what the official history is saying. Because we have less and less trust to government. We have less and less trust in what they say as being the truth. So it came in a good time to Turkey where people are ready to question what was given to them as the truth.
Well, sadly, here in the United States, we have a large group of people who are trying to prevent the true stories from being told, any part of our ugly history from being taught.
That's true. But everywhere, Same in Turkey. It's all everywhere is the same. Same in Turkey, but let's not care about them. Like, I don't want to give energy. Really, I don't want to give energy to them. They're always there in every country. The world is full of them. But there is this other half, let's say, or other 30%, 20%, 10%, whoever. They are trying to find the truth, the truth route. And that truth is for connecting people to one another, not for separating. And that's exactly what we need, to connect with one another, to see the sameness in the loss. Like, we lost all together. Let's acknowledge that and move from there, because that's how we can fill what we lost through connection. And I think it was an amazing, like, magical coincidence for me. The book published on the same day in Greece and in Turkey. Nothing. I didn't make an effort. Publishing houses were unaware of one another. But look at that. And it was my birthday. And nobody knew about that.
Oh.
And I took it as a magical sign from the somewhere sacred, that this is a good step for the humanity.
And what year was that?
It was 2016.
So you wrote the book in 2015.
I wrote the book in 15, yeah.
In 15. And it was published in 2016 in both Greece and Turkey on the same day, on your birthday.
Yes, that's true. March 13th on my birthday.
So tell me your path to publication. How did you find your publisher in Turkey and in Greece? And was it translated into Greek?
No, it was that's also a lovely story. Finding a Turkish publisher was very difficult. Like I told you, I wrote my first book. My first book was about this modern Turkish young woman wanting to become religious and her agony. That was published by a very small publication house in Turkey, and it never became very popular. Then with this book, I know it was a good one. I had full trust in it. And I said, I want a good publisher. I'm not going to my little publisher this time. I'm going to the big guys. And the big guy said, no.
Oh.
Big guy said, this is too long. This is out of our philosophical line, blah, 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 blah. But I really trusted it. And so I continued presenting the book to my friends and friends of friends and friends of friends who are in publishing world. And finally, from the back door of the big guys, I managed to take the book back in. And then one of the publication houses, Doğan Kitap, who is my publisher now, they said, wow, this is really good. Sorry, we haven't seen it before, because we have so many files coming, and, you know, we have a lot of interns actually reading first. And then by the time they're coming to us, most of them, most good ones are eliminated. So sorry, thanks for pushing it. We're going to publish it. And that's how it became. But that took me, that's why, actually, I finished the book in 2015. It was published in 2016, because it took me 1 year to find a publisher.
Well, but then they must have done it pretty quickly, because in the U.S., the major publishers, by the time they say yes, it's usually 2 years before your book comes out.
Yes. No, after that, it was fast. Because I had 1 year searching for a Turkish publication house, I also had that 1 year looking for a publisher in Greece. And I made English summaries of the book, because I didn't speak Greek back then. And I think I submitted the English summary to some of the publication houses. But funny enough, not my English summaries, but one guy who had a publication house in Turkey wrote me one day and said, look, we really liked your novel. We are a very small publication house in Turkey. We want to publish this, but if we publish it, everybody will say, oh, this is like very pro-Greek, so we don't want to do that. But if you want, we will publish this. We will arrange with our partners in Greece to have it published in Greece. Do you want that? So my Greek publisher actually came from Turkey.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Okay. And now, fast forward a few years, and it's being published in English. How did you find your English publisher?
Well, for a long time, I had this. I was a bit. I don't know what's the word for that. Prude, thinking that if my book is good enough, the foreigner publishers will find it. Until the day, a friend of mine, the same friend who is translating her own books into English just to find out if there are any plot flaws or anything. That woman, she told me that, are you out of your mind? How would a foreign publisher find out about your books if they're not in English? You know, like they have to speak Turkish if they're going to find out your book. So if you want a foreign publisher, you have to have at least some part of your book translated in English so they can have an idea what you wrote. So that's how I decided to pay my translations out of pocket and find a translator. And that's the story I told you. Like, I found my translator through a friend. And then I started working with an agency. So I went to an agency, Kalem Agency is my agency, and I said, I have my book already in English. Do you want to take it to London Book Fair for me? And the Kalem Agency, the founder of the Kalem Agency, her name is Nermin, said, sure, give me the book. I'll take it to, and I have a summary. Okay, give me the summary. And I think in the London Book Fair, she's a very good literature agency. She was able to sell the rights to not only to England, but to many, many countries in Europe.
Wow. So it's going to be translated into other languages.
Yes. Yesterday we have the Croatian.
Oh, wow.
Yes. Not only in Europe, like she sold it to India, to Russia, to Kazakhstan. So now it's everywhere in the world.
How exciting.
Of course, the biggest success is in English because, you know, we all speak English now. A book being available in English is a huge step for any writer who is not writing in English, because that means your gates to the global readership is opened.
Right, right. Yeah, I feel very fortunate to be a native English speaker and not have to work hard to be able to to read all these books that are published.
Yeah, I mean, the English speaking, native English speaking authors are so lucky. They're starting the race like 10 steps ahead of us.
Well, it sounds like you're catching up quickly, Daphne.
Well, thank you.
And
I really love writing. That's, you know, I wake up every morning like excited about writing, and like I want everything to end as quickly as possible, breakfast and care of the people, care of the cats and everything, so I can sit down and write.
Oh, and so are you writing as your full-time job, or do you have a day job on top of it?
My day job is I'm a yoga teacher.
Oh, wonderful. That's why your Skype message always says you're at the gym.
Yes. I'm jumping rope. Yeah. Yeah, I teach yoga. I have a school. I'm the founder of a school in Istanbul. Of course, now I do all my classes online. I don't have to be in Istanbul. But I have a very good school with very good teachers working under me. I have very good teachers myself. So that takes a lot of time of my day, not just teaching, but, you know, writing emails and like doing things with yoga, my own yoga. And then when all that finishes, I sit down and
write. Well,
and write.
Daphne, I have so much enjoyed speaking with you, but we're out of time. And we always close with a quote, and I found one from the Arabian Nights.
Okay.
A library of books is the fairest garden in the world, and to walk there is an ecstasy.
How beautiful.
Well, thank you, and good luck. And if I make it to Istanbul or to Turkey again, I'm going to give you a call.
Please do.
All right.
So much.
See you all next week on Writers' Voices.